This is the first day of this July 2013 seven-day session. We're going to take up the teachings of a 19th and 20th century Chinese master, Xu Yun. We'll be reading from a book called Empty Cloud, The Teachings of Xu Yun. He's considered widely considered to be the certainly the most famous, arguably the greatest of the Chinese Zen masters of the 20th century. When I was on pilgrimage in China and Taiwan, we would, with others, we'd run into young men, usually, who would say that they're a disciple of Xu Yun. And we finally figured out that they didn't. It's unlikely they were actually, well, no, they couldn't have been working with him because he died in 1959. But they considered him themselves disciples of his, nonetheless. There's a whole book on the life of Xu Yun. I actually brought it out here with me yesterday, but it's a full-length book, and instead I'm going to read from selected teachings of his. And that's from the text of today, Empty Cloud. That's what Xu Yun means, empty cloud. And this biography is by someone who was his disciple, who may not be alive anymore, a Jidin Shakya, the abbot of Xu Yun Temple in Honolulu, Hawaii. So, short of spending one or two days reading the biography of Xu Yun, I'm just going to read from some of the highlights presented at the beginning of this book, this particular book. The author met Xu Yun in 1934. At a famous monastery in China called Nanhua Monastery. It had been the monastery of the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung. The author describes having first gone to this Nanhua monastery in the 1920s when he was a boy. It had fallen into disrepair. It was founded in 675 and had gone through cycles of neglect and restoration. But the author writes, when I was a boy, it was definitely one of its neglected phases. As I can clearly remember, it was much more like a playground than the shrine it is today. Even so, he says that at the time, there were about 100 monks and a few dozen nuns living there. He says, but mostly they busied themselves with bickering. And the buildings of this great religious center were merely the places in which all these arguments took place. It didn't seem to matter that the wood was rotting and the stonework was crumbling and the ironwork of the old red and white pagoda was rusting. The decay had merely kept pace with the decline in monastic discipline. And then he says that devout Buddhists like his own parents would visit and leave some donations some money in the donation boxes. He and his brother, he described as unruly kids, would climb on the ancient structures, play hide-and-seek behind the Buddha figures, run through the hallways, and nobody objected. He says, we always had a good time whenever we went to Nanhua. But then, it was later in 1934, when the author was in was 17 and Xu Yun was in his 80s, that he met him, and he was very much completely affected by the power and the quality of this Xu Yun, and he became his disciple. A little bit more about Nanhua Monastery. The monks and nuns raised their own vegetables, did their own cooking and cleaning, and even sewed their own clothes. They slept on wooden planks that were covered only by a thin grass mat. Money was obtained from charitable donations and from rent received from tenant farmers who leased monastery land. Well, this goes way back. Way back to the Tang Dynasty, where the Chan monasteries were these huge, huge spreads of property where tenant farmers would just do that, would pay rent, and that's what part of what supported the work of the monastery and the monks. A little more here. When Xu Yun arrived at Nanhua in 1934, he knew that there could be no happiness there until discipline was restored. He therefore established strict rules and regulations. The first time someone broke a rule, he or she was punished. The second time that person broke a rule, he or she was dismissed. Xu Yun departmentalized all the various jobs and duties and established a hierarchy, an ascending order of responsibility, to oversee each department. Everybody had to do his job, and Xu Yun tolerated no laxity. He had a strong stick which he carried with him wherever he went, and he was not afraid to use it. Amazingly, all of the arguments and misbehavior ceased. Law and order brought peace. But it was not enough to restore monastic discipline. Xu Yun knew that the monastery buildings also had to be restored. And then there's just a little bit more about this. Is, of course, as I said, very late in Xu Yun's life. He was in his 80s and 90s, in the period covered here by this introduction by the author. War broke out when the Japanese invaded China. They attacked Shanghai, Nanjing, the rape of Nanjing. Xu Yun began a program of refugee assistance. There were hundreds of thousands of Chinese who became refugees to escape the terrors of the war. Xu Yun decreed that the monks of Nanhua adopt the ancient Buddhist custom of eating only two meals a day, breakfast and lunch. This, by the way, is still the practice in the Theravadan Buddhist centers. Even in our own country, there are Theravadan Buddhist centers, Vipassana centers, where some of the retreats, the meditation retreats, serve only breakfast and lunch, nothing afternoon. Although, I got to take that back, they find some kind of a loophole where they serve some kind of third meal, a light third meal. The same loophole was employed in Japan when I was there. In Japan, often it's just the outer form that is honored. And so the idea behind this, only twice eating twice a day, breakfast and lunch, is that it came from the regulations of the Buddha himself, the Vinaya, during the Buddha's lifetime. The loophole is that there is for medicinal purposes, you could have some medicinal foods in the late in the day, like, you know, late meaning 5 or something. And when I was in Japan, you would have that that supper every single day, and they called it yakuseki, which means medicine meal. It was the same as breakfast and lunch, basically. It was rice and when I was there, it was just leftover white rice from breakfast mixed with leftover brown rice from lunch. But because they called it yakuseki, medicine meal, it became just standard operating procedure. But here, Shuyun decreed that it would be only breakfast and lunch, or at least according to this account. But the point here is that the food that would have been eaten was donated to the war refugees and, when necessary, to Chinese soldiers. Because of the people's great distress, Shuyun held many additional religious services for the dead and injured. Still, he writes here, to Shuyun, a goal was a goal, and not even the Japanese invasion would deter him from restoring Nanhua Monastery. And so the rebuilding of the monastery continued. After the Japanese attacked Nanjing and Shanghai, there was a big meeting at this Nanhua Monastery. That gives you a sense of how prominent it was. A meeting of the governors from 14 Chinese provinces. And just to kind of sum up here, the Japanese got wind of this big governmental meeting at Nanhua, and they sent out 3 fighter bombers to attack the monastery in order to take out these governors. But it says Shuyun just went to the Zendo to pray for everyone's safety. And then with these 3 fighter bombers bearing down on the monastery and actually strafing the monastery, 2 of the 3 planes crashed into each other and went down. And the author attributes this to Shuyun's spiritual power. He says, all the Chinese who knew him had no doubt about this, but what is more important, the Japanese evidently began to believe it. 2. Governors or no governors, they never again attempted to bomb Nanhua. A few other little nuggets here. Because Shuyun believed in the necessity of providing children with a good education, he also decided to establish a primary school at Nanhua. There was this the Chinese Civil War, where Mao Zedong marched his long march and finally prevailed. The nationalists fled to what is now called Taiwan, and the war ended. The Civil War ended in 1949. Mao took over, and cadres of communist thugs went on a rampage, thinking that the monasteries were repositories of hidden gold and other valuables. They marched in and demanded that the monks turn over these treasures to them, but the treasures didn't exist. In 1951, a bunch of these thugs came to another monastery that Shuyun had taken responsibility for, Yunmen Monastery. That's the famous Yunmen, Umon, and demanded that Shuyun give them the temple's gold and valuables. Well, he tried to explain that there were no such valuables at Yunmen Monastery, but they didn't believe him, and one by one they beat the monks in an effort to force Shuyun to disclose where the treasure was. One monk was actually beaten to death. Several monks disappeared. Their bodies were never found. They occupied the monastery for 3 months. They would regularly interrogate and beat Shuyun and then throw him into a small dark room for days, depriving him of food and water. Several times he was beaten into unconsciousness and left for dead. He was 93 at the time. But he did survive, and he actually recovered. And then Shuyun went to the capital and persuaded the Chinese government, I guess Mao, to lay off. And finally, when Shuyun was 101 in 1959, he died. If you want to read the whole biography of this remarkable man, there is a book, a full book about it, called Empty Cloud. And so now I'm going to start reading from Shuyun's own words. Begins with an introduction. Now, unfortunately, in this slim volume, it nowhere mentions when these talks were given. Was he 80, 90, 100? My guess, because of the simplicity of the language, I would suggest it's later in his life, maybe at least 90, when he wrote this. There's a kind of a childlike simplicity to it. But we'll just read the record as it is. And he begins, this is Shuyun. Dear friends, let me tell you a little story a wise man once told me. He said, once I found myself in an unfamiliar country walking down a strange street. I looked around trying to get my bearings, and seeing 2 men who were standing nearby, I approached them. Where am I? I asked. Who are you people? The first man replied, this is the world of samsara, and in this world I happen to be the very tallest dwarf there is. And the other man replied, yes, and I happen to be the shortest giant. This left me very confused because, you see, both men were exactly the same height. I preface my remarks to you with this little story because I want to emphasize at the outset how important it is to consider the perception of things. The perception of things. He continues, in the world of samsara, the human being is the measure of all things. Everything is relative. Everything is changing. Only in the real world, the world of nirvana, is there constancy. In Chan, our task is to discriminate, not between the false and the false, but between the false and the real. Differences in outward appearance do not matter at all. The real world is inside us. It is even inside our mind. Well, just to make one comment, uh, even to say the real world is inside our mind shows the limitations of words. We can't speak of inside or outside. And even to call it the real world places it in opposition to the unreal world. Of course, Xu Yun knows this through his deep enlightenment, but he's using words to make some basic points, and he's not going to get caught up in the problem with all words, which is they're fundamentally dualistic. He says, "Now it is my happy task to help you to gain entrance into the real world, the world in which there are no dwarfs and giants and meaningless arguments. In the real world, there is only peace and joy and truth and freedom from the nagging desire for troublesome illusions." So, samsara. Samsara, most of you must know, samsara is the ancient Buddhist word to refer to the ordinary world of illusory phenomena. And that means physical phenomena, mental phenomena. The whole world of thoughts is all part of samsara. Every kind of concept or principle is part of samsara. Gaining and losing, success, failure, right and wrong, dying, living, succeeding, failing, all of this is all in the realm of samsara. These are phenomena. These are mental constructs. And it all is one side of reality. The other side is we could call nirvana. But again, what we discover through awakening is that ultimately these are just relative terms, and that the world of so-called samsara is not other than the world of nirvana. But still, there is the experience of nirvana that reveals these. It's only by experiencing that world of that is beyond phenomena that we realize the non-dual nature of samsara and nirvana. Here again, he distinguishes between these two sides, the side that everyone knows and the other. "Dear friends, every human being possesses two self-natures, an apparent one and a real one. The apparent one is our small self or ego, which is different everywhere from all other small selves. The real self is our great Buddha self, which is everywhere the same. Our small self exists in the apparent world, the world of samsara. Our Buddha nature exists in the real world, the world of nirvana." And then he says, "Both worlds are located in the same place." In the Heart Sutra, that's the Prajnaparamita, we read, "Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness not other than form." Everyone wants to know, how can samsara and nirvana be the same? How can illusion be the same as reality? How can I be me and the Buddha too? These are good questions. Every Buddhist needs to know the answer to them. The answer lies in the way we perceive reality. If we perceive reality directly, we see it in its nirvanic purity. If we perceive it indirectly through our ego consciousness, we see it in its samsaric distortion. Recently, I gave a short talk at a local TED conference, and I began my talk by flatly pointing out that that our whole experience of reality is determined by the mind. Everything is perception. And it is to offer a new perspective that Zen practice, that's how it works. And by coming to Sesshin, we come to this new perspective on things. It's not that there's a world of samsara out there somewhere, or a world of nirvana out there somewhere, because we can't talk about an out there that's apart from our own mind. Perception determines everything. Our perspective is what matters. That's the whole premise of meditation. By changing the mind, we change our life, our experience, because we're changing our perception. I mentioned in the talk about a famous study on happiness that happened in the 1980s, where they studied two small populations. One were those who had won the lottery, and then the other were those who had been recently diagnosed HIV positive. And they had ways of measuring self-reported happiness, levels of happiness. And then 4 years later, they went back to the same lottery winners and the same people who had been diagnosed HIV positive, and they tested them in the same way for happiness. And they found that the people who had been diagnosed HIV positive 4 years earlier reported higher levels of happiness than the lottery winners. Our whole experience of life is determined by the mind. It's not just circumstances. Yes, circumstances, of course, play a role. But here were these two wildly divergent groups. One that would be envied by most people in the world who had won the lottery, and the others who had have the opposite feeling from most people in the world. There is no world of nirvana apart from the mind, and the same with samsara. Again, the answer lies in the way we perceive reality. If we perceive reality directly, we see it in its nirvanic purity. If we perceive it indirectly through our ego consciousness, this would be the lottery winners, we see it in its samsaric distortion. Why is our view of reality flawed? He goes on, samsara is the world our small self thinks it sees and apprehends with its senses. Sometimes we just make mistakes. If a man were walking in the woods and came upon a coil of rope on the path, and he thought the rope was a snake, he'd quickly run away. To him, that rope was a snake, and he'd react accordingly. When he returned home, he'd probably tell everyone about that dangerous snake that almost bit him in the woods. His fear was genuine. His reason for being afraid was not. His fear was genuine. You can't deny that his fear was genuine, but his reason for being afraid was not. The small ego self also misperceives reality whenever it imposes arbitrary aesthetic or moral judgments upon it. If one woman sees another woman who is wearing a green hat and says, "I see a woman who is wearing a green hat," there's no problem. But if she says, "I see a woman who is wearing an ugly green hat," she is making a samsaric judgment. Somebody else might find that hat beautiful. But in reality, it is neither beautiful nor ugly. It merely is. There's this famous Latin statement there that means basically there is no accounting for taste. It's surprising how many people will, maybe without even noticing it, will make judgments in which they'll flat out say that is ugly, that is beautiful, that's the right color, that's the wrong color. And they imagine that they know that it just is, that's the way it is. Forgetting that everything depends. It's all subjective, really. Ultimately, it's all subjective. Of course, there can be a consensus of something that is more attractive than something else. But still, it all is subjective judgments. Likewise, when a fox kills a rabbit, to the bunnies who will starve to death because their mother has been killed, this is an evil act. But to the hungry fox cubs who eat the rabbit that their mother has brought them, the same event is decidedly good. In reality, the event is neither good nor evil. It merely is. So I think anyone can understand this. This is just rational points he's making. But understanding it is one thing. It's another to notice when one is imposing unnecessary judgments, or whether moral judgments or aesthetic judgments on situations. We so reflexively do this. It's so ingrained in us to react to circumstances in this way. We become dominated by our judgments. He continues, reality is also misinterpreted because both the observer and that which is being observed are constantly changing. There is no precise moment in which a bud becomes a bloom, or a bloom becomes a fruit, or a fruit becomes a seed, or a seed a budding tree. All these changes are subtle and continuous. We cannot step into the same river twice, for the water is constantly flowing. We also are not the same person from one minute to the next. Constantly we acquire new information and new experiences as we simultaneously forget old information and old experiences. Yesterday we can recall what we had for dinner the evening before. Tomorrow we will no longer be privileged to recall that menu, unless perhaps it was a sumptuous feast of some kind. Or else we always eat the same food and can say with certainty it was rice and tofu. The illusion of life is the opposite of the illusion of the cinema. In the cinema, a series of individual images are run together to form the illusion of continuous movement. In life, however, we interpret continuous motion, isolate and freeze an image, and then name and fix it as though it were a concrete individual object or event. We don't always agree on fixing the moment in time. What is a young woman? If a man is 90 years old, lots of women are young women. So in the affirming faith in mind, we chant, these two are merely relative and both at source are emptiness. Goes back to the example he used at the beginning, the tallest dwarf and the shortest giant. Distinctions such as large and small have relevance for you no more. The largest is the smallest too. Here, limitations have no place. That whole chant, the affirming faith in mind, is directing our attention to this realm that is beyond discrimination. It's not saying that there's no place for discrimination. We need to discriminate all the time. We need to discriminate between a green traffic signal and a red traffic signal. We need to distinguish between what is ours and what belongs to others. So of course distinctions have their place, a big place. But if we see only differences and we don't see the sameness, the oneness out of which all distinctions arise, then we're not seeing things as they are. We're seeing just things, just half of reality. He continues, well, we may have a better idea of why our small self misperceives reality, but still we wonder, why do we have two selves in the first place? The answer is simply because we are human beings. Our small self provides us with that conscious sense of continuing identity that allows each of us to know, I am today who I was yesterday and will be again tomorrow. Without it, we could not organize the sensory data that assail us. Without it, we would have no sense of belonging or of being connected to others. We would have no parents or family to call our own, no spouse or children, no teachers or friends to guide and encourage us. Our small self gives us our human nature. So, where he says we need, to put another way, as when we are children, we need to develop a sense of self as a way of, organizing the world. It has its place. But that's just one side of things. As we grow, we discover that our lifeline's thread is not a long, continuous strand with each event separately strung on it like beads on a rosary. No, the thread weaves itself into a net, an interdependent array of knots. We cannot remove a single knot without affecting the others. We cannot pull out a single line of our history without perhaps altering the entire course of it. This network of information and experience, of conditioning and association, of memory and misunderstanding soon becomes a complicated and bewildering tangle, and we become confused about our place in the scheme of things. When we are young, we see ourselves at the center of our universe, but as we get older, we are no longer certain of our position or our identity. We think, I'm not the person I was when I was 10 years old, but neither am I anybody different. We soon wonder, who am I? Our ego self has led us into this confusion. Confusion leads to calamity, and then life, as the Buddha noted in his First Noble Truth, becomes bitter and painful. How do we clear up this confusion? We turn our consciousness around. We reject the outward world's complexity in favor of the inward world's simplicity. That's really what a simple way of saying what Sesshin is all about. It's a way of simplifying our understanding of life, of reality, by simplifying the mind. Instead of trying to gain power and glory for our small ego self, we turn our consciousness inward to discover the glory of our Buddha nature. Instead of making ourselves wretched, seeking to be a master of others, we find joy and contentment in being one with our Buddha self and in serving others. Dear friends, the purpose of Chan training, Zen training, is to clarify our vision so that we can gain insight into our true identities. Chan enables us to transcend our human nature and realize our Buddha nature. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.